society take advantage of networks and connectivity to improve.
Particularly if we are going to harness the opportunities that are inherent in the accelerating growth curve of the Internet of Things.
Today, connectivity is becoming ubiquitous and society is transitioning towards a network society.
Hello, and welcome to Network Society Stories, the podcast where we explore ways to harness the power of growing connectivity and emerging technology to create positive social impact. My name is Kate Murray, and today we have for you a special treat. Professor Luciano Floridi giving the keynote speech at our Network Society Symposium 2017. Floridi is Professor of Philosophy and Ethics of Information at Oxford Internet Institute at the University of Oxford, where he is also Director of the Digital Ethics Lab. Now, this talk was delivered by a philosopher in an event held at the Melbourne School of Design, hosted by a research institute that sits under the Melbourne School of Engineering. And Floridi reflects this interdisciplinary context very well in his talk. In this podcast, you will be given an overview of the cleaving powers of digitization and the challenges we face. You'll learn the role of environmental sustainability in a digital world, where we are wanting increasing energy sourced to power our devices, and hear about the responsibility we have to future generations. In fact, the talk begins with a brief discussion of the University of Melbourne motto, Postera Crescam Lauda, which means we grow in the esteem of future generations. Floridi decorates each step of this fascinating intellectual journey with quotes from Shakespeare, images of his grandmother's fridge, or a metaphor of mangroves growing in brackish water. Floridi is a warm and humorous speaker, and amongst the fun and analogies are some deep ideas on how the digital is changing us as people, our environment, and what it all means from a philosophical view. It is a long talk, but we just couldn't cut any of it out, so I'll pop in halfway through to offer you a break and give you a time to get a cup of tea. So here it is, the green and the blue, the smart deal for a sustainable and preferable future, delivered by Professor Luciano Floridi, the keynote speaker at University of Melbourne's Network Society Symposium 2017. Enjoy.
I could spend about the 45 minutes we have together explaining what the heck a philosopher does in a school of design together with engineers. I won't waste your time apologizing profusely for being here, but too many decades in England not to have that temptation, as you may imagine. So if you take for granted the apologies for even existing, that would be the British in me. A couple of points before we start talking about the actual topic. Introductory remarks. One thing that I was tempted to do, and I know you know, was to look at your mobile phone and then say, what exactly postera crescam lauda means? Now, if you come from Oxford, you have that Latin temptation to say, do they really mean what they're saying there? That's a Horatio for you, thinking about future generations, looking back and saying, thank you for the work you've done. Now, that's not small ambition, and the connection with what we're doing today here at the Institute in Melbourne and in Oxford as well with the other people there is to make sure that the foundations of the information society will be something that postera, the future generations, will be thankful for. Now, you may think that that is a task that can be postponed, shuffled on someone else's shoulders, but it isn't. It's actually today, and by today I mean this generation, that we have the task of putting together the kind of good foundational stones that will provide a decent place for the future. We are the only generation, I'm afraid, that has actually seen the world moving from a completely analog and only analog world to something that is also digital and increasingly digital. It's not going to happen again. We know that. Future generations will see other transformations, and we know that. History doesn't stop here, of course. But that transition, that landing on that new continent called the digital continent, that is a one-off. It's like the invention of the wheel, the agricultural revolution. It happens once, and then the consequences are very long-term. In terms of a little introduction to the talk today, one way, and then if you want to check your email for the rest of the hour, that's fine. One message to take away is it's all about doing the right thing now because we have the opportunity to do the right thing now. And it's much easier. It will get increasingly difficult to rectify anything that we either haven't done properly, or done wrongly today. Now, try that line with some of the major companies, and it takes a little bit more convincing power and arm twisting than just, of course, yeah. But they're getting there, too. Good citizenship from a corporate world is becoming something that is almost taken for granted. Now, that is the kind of mild optimism that I would like to convey today to you. And if you think that is a bit too much, let's try to be optimistic 4 days a week. So, you know, just a bit more often than you know, the gloomy things about all the problems that we're seeing and all the difficulties that are around the corner. So that as a way of sort of introducing the topic for today. The title is slightly misleading as a clickbait, so to speak, because I will not speak too much about the green and the blue until the very end of the presentation. It's more the idea of being programmatic. And in case anyone is worried about this, I shall be superficial and shallow. That's a feature, not a bug, so please don't criticize. I meant to be shallow and superficial so that hopefully during the 45 minutes that we have together, I will be able to attract everybody at least to one slide or one topic. So, in terms of where are we and how we're going to get lost in this long walk, there will be a map coming up. The map is the following, and so if you miss any episode, just stay with me because the map will pop up again, and it was, oh, that's where we are. So I will give you a bit of a background in terms of a couple of concepts, time, space, and society, no, just small things, to be on the same page. The normal line here from the philosopher is that you don't have to agree with me, but as long as we disagree on something we mutually understand, that's okay. So that's the minimal requirement. Disagreement on something we really both understand, as opposed to not talking to each other, passing by. So that will be a bit of background. Then I will introduce one concept, which is the cleaving power of the digital. For most people in this room, who are probably native speakers, to cleave is a natural word. For a foreigner like me, it's more confusing than Theresa May. The point being that, of course, to cleave means at the same time to join and disjoin. And that is not terribly helpful sometimes, but in this case, it will be a semantic feature that I will exploit to talk about the digital in terms of how the digital is changing the world. And I will point out 8 plus 2, because we have 10 fingers, so inevitably it has to be 10 points, 10 ways in which the digital is changing the world under our eyes. Then some challenges, and guess what? Another 10 challenges, so that we have that kind of number in mind. And if some of them will require a little bit of stretching or some will be too obvious, please stay with me. And this was a total fluke. I did not know we were going to be in this building. However, convergence sometimes is reassuring. So I will talk about design as the counterpart of the cleaving power. I'm not going to tell you too much now, because otherwise you won't pay any attention. But hopefully this kind of lingering interest in what is going to talk about when talking about design will stay with us. So that will be probably half an hour from now. And finally, the green and the blue, as I can tell you, is coming at the end more programmatically than in terms of a specific set of recommendations. So the background. This is where we ended yesterday. We had a wonderful seminar, and we ended talking about digital ethics with a famous sentence from Macbeth. This is actually meeting the three witches. You know, it doesn't end well, but the idea behind is that he's asking about the future. And his sentence is beautiful. He says, "You who can look into the seeds of time and say which grain will grow and which will not. The should not is actually my change, my addition. That's exactly what we do sometimes in when we think about technology. No determinism. It's up to us to decide which seeds to put there. But then that's the kind of stuff is going to grow. And if you don't like what is going to grow, well, change the seeds, because those are the seeds and those are the plants. So there's a big necessity between the if and the then, and we can change the if. But once you have that if there, the premises, well, the then follows, you know, more strictly. So if you don't like the kind of future for which we might be blamed by future generations, we better make sure that the foundations today are the right ones. So with this perspective, I want to warn you, no, there's no determinism in what I'm going to talk about, not at all, but there's a sense of consequences following from steps taken. And that's good policy. I said something about the premises, so determinism is out of the way. Second point, time. Well, we live in a hyper-historical society. By this, I mean we move from prehistory, about 6,000 years ago, to history. That's textbook material for anyone here. By adopting some kind of information and communication technologies. Normally writing, but it could have been something else. Once you start writing, meaning you can record the present for future consumption, you know that biology is no longer a constraint. If grandma didn't pass on the recipe prehistorically, that's it, that's the cake gone. But luckily, she can write it down, and that's why I can still make it for my wife. So we move from prehistory to history by having recording gadgets, which means that at that point, individual and, and social well-being start being related to ICTs. There is no Roman Empire without writing. There is no Egyptians, there is no Athens, there is nothing without the ability to have contracts, to make sure that those are the rules, that someone says so, that culture can grow and someone can actually pass on documents from the past. So this relationship is exactly what qualifies history compared to prehistory in this particular point. So why hyper-history? Some of you, some of us, have been exposed to, remember the old narrative, the end of history, those were the 90s, yeah, good old days, Clinton and everything else, what happened? Yeah. But that idea was actually a mistake. We're becoming more historical if that relation becomes a dependence. So individual and social well-being today, they depend on ICT. They're not just related to. And any society like the one in which we live here grows and flourishes thanks to this particular infrastructure. It's the added value, it's the extra bit that makes a difference. And you know, you can have a test whether someone is living in a hyper-historical society or not by asking simply, would you be subject to a cyber attack? Oh, yes. Or then, my dear, you're totally dependent on that particular sofa on which you are sitting, called the digital. If anyone pulls a leg, you're going to be bumping on the floor. So time as hyper-history. What about space? So this is the kind of framework in terms of the experience we're having. Space has also been modified by the digital. I like to use an engineering word, envelope. An envelope for an engineer, a mechanical engineer, is a 3D space within which a robot can achieve its particular tasks. Now, you build the envelope around the robot, not the other way around. And what we've been doing for a long time now is enveloping the world around the simple abilities of our technologies. Lower cost, more computation, more data, better machine learning, better algorithms, more Internet of Things, more on life. I'll tell you a bit more about that in a moment. But essentially, wrapping the world around the technologies, which therefore are increasingly successful, and wrap the world even more around those technologies, which then become more successful. And all of a sudden, you become someone who is a bit of a guest in a world where the real sort of ordinary citizens are the digital citizens. And I mean the software out there. We scuba dive. They are the fish in this digital world. Now, in that particular sense, this is what we really live in. We live in a big dishwasher. If you think of that, that's the big envelope, now the box, and the stupid little robot inside can work because the box has been built around its very simple abilities. This is the usual mistake you find in newspapers, Hollywood movies, and some fancy philosophers in California. Now, the Terminator, or in this case, the robot that does the dishes as I do the dishes. Not really. But that's what I want to have for Christmas. That is enveloping the kitchen around the ability of an arm that does my work at the moment, namely putting the dirt dishes inside the dishwasher, which is another envelope world out there. And if we could envelope, look at the top right, that little camera and the arm, if we could envelope the kitchen around the ability of the robot, that would mean that I can do something else instead of shuffling the dishes in and putting that back. So all that space, I like to call it the infosphere, the space of information within which we are increasingly spending more and more time. Now, hyperhistory, time, infosphere, space. Moving forward, we used to share all that environment with different agents, animals, and so on. We move on, and we had plenty of artifacts at some point, but today, that is the kind of world we are increasingly bumping into. Now, this is just a little robot, has been already tested in the streets of London for delivery of food and mail by Amazon. It's not science fiction. It's the reality with which we are dealing on a daily basis. So where exactly are we living here? A hyper-historical time, an infosphere space, lots of other agents around. That's the kind of, remember, future that we are building for generations to come to appreciate, hopefully. Well, here's the last bit of background that I want to share with you. In that context, those are mangroves, and they grow where the river meets the sea. There's the brackish water there. And imagine someone among the mangroves asking you, is the water salty or sweet? The answer to that question is, you haven't got a clue where you are. There is no sweet or salty. There is no analog or digital. There is no online or offline. Now, welcome to the mangrove society. I mean, the world where we are a bit of both. There's a bigger mix between the two sides of the river and the sea. And there is the expansion space, the hyperhistorical time, the infosphere, within which more and more people are converging. So to speak, people from the river and the sea are coming to that particular space. Okay, so that's the background. What difference does it all make? I mentioned this cleaving power, and luckily, not in every language this translates so nicely, but in English, cut and paste, it's a good way of translating to cleave. It has that particular, as I said, confusing ability to put together, but also put apart, gluing and ungluing at the same time, depending on how you use it. Now, the digital here has been gluing and ungluing, so putting together or separating things from the past, and if you want to be fancy, we can call it modernity, but no, from, shall we say, the last couple of centuries, where things or concepts about things have been inherited by us as either completely separate, and therefore, how can you possibly combine them into a unity, or a single unit, which we didn't think could be easily sort of unglued into components. So what I'm suggesting here, and now I will give you 8 particular examples of this gluing and ungluing, is that the digital with this cleaning power, this cut and paste of things and concepts about things, is separating or unifying stuff that until recently was considered to be either separate for good or unified for good. So it's reshuffling what are the atoms or the molecules of our culture. So let me give you now 8 examples, and some of this will be, I hope, totally trivial, as I said, well-known, and is mainly to remind everyone of what is already happening. Presence and location. They've been unglued, of course. I mean, today it's just the most ordinary thing. But even for my grandfather, that would have been inconceivable. You are where you work and interact, and you work and interact where you are. And say, okay, fine, well, now you are located someplace, say maybe in a particular bar, but you are present on Facebook, and or you're present on a particular online job that you're doing for Amazon. That's fine. So what? Well, this is, for example, what happens when you haven't quite grasped the point. This is the number of branches of banks in the United States in terms of the one open and the one closed. And look at the red line. Of course, we're closing down branches of banks because a branch for a bank has been built in terms of modernity. Location and presence are a unity. You go to the bank to do things at the bank, no longer, of course, who has been to a bank in the last few weeks. So how do you reinvent the presence and location? Well, you know that you want to have the people in that place, and to have them there, you need to offer them something that they cannot have anywhere else. They have to be there bodily. So this is another graph, and those are the coffee shops in the United States. Of course, I mean, at some point, people like me, they start looking at bookstores, and bookstores start having coffee shops. I just thought, oh, that's a silly, or just a way of making a little bit of money on the side. No, it's to reunite location and presence. That's the smart move. Because in order to get a coffee, you have to be there. You can't have a coffee on the digital world. And once you're there, maybe you look at the books, and maybe you buy something, or maybe not. Either way, it's a win-win, because you buy the coffee, that's money, and you buy a coffee and a book, and that's more money. But above all, that's the number of places that are growing as opposed to the branches. Well, that's interesting. So talking to a bank, HSBC or Barclays, they immediately understand what they need to do. Give them a coffee. Clear. So next time you go to a bank and they start offering you a coffee, you know what's happening here. You know? Location and presence being reunited under a single unity. Law and territoriality. We had endless discussion when I was a member of the advisory board for Google on the right to be forgotten. I could bother you for hours on the topic. I won't, but you'll warn in case there's any question on this. What's happening here? Well, the picture you have there is mid-17th century. France is highlighted because it's essentially what has happened between the Three Musketeers and 20 years later. If you remember, as I hope, the end of the Three Musketeers, say goodbye, etc. When they meet again, Westphalia has happened. And the Westphalian system has organized Europe. The damage we have caused in that continent is staggering. Now, we kill each other for a long time, World War Zero, to be honest, but until we reach Westphalia. And once we reach Westphalia, well, it took millions of deaths and suffering to not limit to get to the falling point. My place, my rules, your place, your rules. Which, you know, it could have taken a few millions less deaths and huge amount of suffering less. But at that point, law and territoriality, they start being one on top of each other. The border of the law is the border of the nation. Well, welcome to cyberspace, infosphere. So when France recently asked Google to remove links from the search engine and said, no, it's not enough to remove it from the French version, it's not enough to remove it from the European version, you have to remove it from the American version. And Google says, well, welcome to the post-Westphalian world, where, my dear France, this is no longer the Three Musketeers world, and the borders of your law are irrelevant on cyberspace. And then France replies, well, actually, but that's one click away. Now, what's the point in removing the links from the search engine in France and in Europe if the kid can just, like, go google.com? Well, in fact, can actually set up this as the default search engine. And the reply comes, tough luck, yes. And we don't have a mechanism to reorganize that today. Essentially, we have not a solution that is widely accepted as the Westphalian mechanism was. So the ungluing of law and territoriality, something that we haven't yet managed to solve forward. I'll be quicker now because I think you'll get a taste. So for each of the next slides, we could spend a whole lecture discussing it. But say ownership and usage, Uber, Airbnb, you name it, who now needs to own anything in order to make money out of it? Of course, that has been with us for some time, but it wasn't in the past. So ownership and usage today are unglued by the digital. Or shall we say agency and intelligence? There's an unfortunate myth in the press that artificial intelligence means a marriage between the artificial and the intelligent. It's actually a divorce. Is the ability to do things without the need to be intelligent. That's why you can actually do them. Pick up your phone, and if it is like mine, you won't be able to win any game of chess. And yet, the intelligence of that iPhone is my grandmother's fridge intelligence. Zero. Nothing. I hope you agree. So how come that is so much more successful? Well, precisely because we have found a way of making sure that the success does not require any intelligence anymore. So here is how we define artificial intelligence. It is from 1955, one of the best applications ever made. Now, this is They were applying for a little money to organize that workshop. That was McCarthy, Minsky, Rochester, and Shannon. And some of the names there, you know, they made a history of our discipline. I met McCarthy when much later in life, and his disappointment about AI was staggering. He said, well, we got it completely wrong. I don't want to have a software that can win chess. I want to have the real thing, something that thinks like a human. And to John, I said, well, John, I'm afraid, but you're the wrong side of history. We are engineering things that are better than us, and yet with no intelligence whatsoever, no consciousness, no semantics, no understanding. It doesn't matter. It's like asking whether a submarine can swim. That's not the point. It does what it's supposed to do, and it does it well. So look at the definition here, and it's in a logic context, it's a counterfactual. It says, if you were a human, that human would have to be intelligent to do it. If I were to do the dishes as my dishwasher does the dishes, I would have to exercise some intelligence, as my wife reminds me. Don't be such a robot. No, don't pay attention. So does the dishwasher need any intelligence? Of course not. Trouble is that if you walk into my house and you look at the glasses or the dishes and they are all clean, you wouldn't know who cleaned the dishes. It is, again, in a logic terms, irreversible. You can't go from the output back to the input. And that's why we get confused. Oh, my goodness, we don't know. Therefore, nothing. Therefore, the dishwasher, no, it's just a mechanical thing, very smart, that does the dishes properly. So in this case, what we have is agency as the capacity to perform a task to fulfill a goal. And we are implementing more and more wonderful engineered artifacts that do this very well instead of us, better than us. And honestly, the sky's the limit. Production and consumption. Now I'm talking about gluing together things that were not glued for a long time. This has been with us since the 80s. Produmer, anyone has been around for a while. The videos on YouTube that you put there are also the videos that someone else is consuming. Facebook is actually based on the production and consumption. They don't put anything there. It's all us on us. And honestly, production and consumption, if you are in the editorial business or publishing your paper and then buying back from the publisher your paper, well, welcome to the model, right? There's something a bit dodgy about this, but we've been there for a long time, Elsevier and Springer and all the rest. Gluing together. Well, we are re-gluing authenticity and memory thanks to blockchain. Think of it. I mean, when we were in the 80s and 90s, asking whether that file was the genuine, original, authentic file compared to a copy, insane. I know this is a tool file. It doesn't matter. I mean, one is the perfect clone of the other. Unless you know the history, as it were, the DNA of that file. And at some point, if you introduce that authenticity in connection with memory, namely blockchain, and you have a whole ladder of how we got from there to there, well, you know which one is the authentic and which one is not. It doesn't matter, of course, when it comes to a copy of your, say, the file of your thesis, for the younger in here, but it does matter if the food chain is in question, because blockchain and food chain go hand in hand. And that's why, for example, the great agricultural industry is totally interested in this. That's why the notary association in Europe is totally interested in blockchain, because, of course, the authenticity of their contract is guaranteed by the history of their contract and on. So we are reuniting here something that we had split in the past. And then information and identity. Now, this, Dr. Jekyll would be quite disappointed, but today he's just a data subject as any other. And I'm afraid for Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, they would be the same individual because they are just the same data subject. This is terminology from the European Union. I'm not sure whether the same terminology is used also in Australia. We do adopt the same terminology in the UK. The idea that you are your information and your identity and information are two sides of the same coin. Now, that was not quite clear, say, for my grandparents. However, if you remember how, I don't want to spoil it for you, but how the Odyssey ends, it's a good ending. Well, there's a lot of biometric identification of that guy landing on an island. The dog, the scar, and that bit of information that he shares only with the other person, the wife, again, without spoiling for you, that's also biometric. So we've been there, yes and no, for a while, but now, today, that's total unity of what we mean by personal identity. And I mentioned this before, the on-life experience. It was a project that I chaired for the European Commission on the impact of technologies on European citizens. I had to find a word to mean this particular space where you're neither online nor offline, where basically you're driving a car, you're being instructed by your GPS where to go, like the cab driver today who didn't have a clue about where the University of Melbourne was in the whole city. But luckily he had a little bit of GPS instructing him where to go left and right, and quite loudly. So, turn left now. So, online, offline, pointless. Again, not knowing where you are. On life, a better terminology. We've been there in a way before. Now, this is, say, grandmother walking to a computer inside, and basically software engineering was a screwdriver business, literally. Of course, her daughter got out, and the computer became something outside, in front of her. But her granddaughter, she's back inside. And she knows that she's inside only when it doesn't work. Only when you go around, like, there's no connectivity here. How can it possibly be? Where's my EduROM here? So at some point you are inside the dishwasher. Remember? A place which is not entirely made for us, but it's friendly to digital creatures that are there as the native original entities, the organism at home. Now, some challenges first. So, okay, well, this cat and paste, suppose we are on the same page, more or less, maybe not, but I kind of like the story, see where it goes. What kind of problems are this generating? And I like to call them maybe challenges. Don't want to give you the impression that it's all for the worst and the negative. I mean, I think I like very much the video we had at the beginning. Technology is there for us and is a good move. It's something that you definitely want to have, unless you want to go back 100 years and go to the dentist 100 years ago. Because the house we have in the countryside, there was a guy who actually also was shoeing horses, working as a dentist. And he had the same tools for the shoe of the horse and your teeth. Now, that is the kind of technology that I would like to remind my colleagues when they start going, oh, technology, this disaster, no, has ruined life and everything else. Oh, really? And when did you read that? No, I hope not on an iPad, because that is exactly what technology has done for you. And most likely, you are here because of technology. I'm not sure how many of us would be here if it hadn't been for that particular hospital technology, etc. So, don't get me wrong. I'll tell you a bit about problems, but those are challenges that we can solve. Remember, if then.
You are listening to The Green and the Blue, the smart deal for a sustainable and preferable future, delivered by Professor Luciano Floridi at University of Melbourne's Network Society Symposium 2017. We hope you're enjoying the podcast so far. For more information or to see the accompanying slides, visit our website, networksociety.unimelb.edu.au. Now, back to the talk.
Work, of course, that's going to be a big challenge. The gentleman in question doesn't have a job anymore. You had to have a license to operate an elevator. Of course, that's gone. But what is going is not his job entirely. It's his role, because now I'm doing it. I'm the one pushing buttons here. Likewise, the lady in question, she might actually not have that particular task if the GPS in the car start talking to each other one day. It's a huge waste of brain power, to be honest, translating GPS instructions into maneuvering and maneuvering to GPS. This gentleman, we made a mistake a long time ago. And his job, unless that kind of car disappears, he's assured. There's more than a billion cars around the world. And guess what? We have human brains, the most fantastic thing that the universe ever created, as far as we know. And we use them to take the thing, put it in and back. That's extraordinary. Meanwhile, you got robots on Mars. No, remote control. But we didn't think about this. We didn't design this thing to be automatic process, and someone has to do it, and that normally is a human being, and only a human being. So if anyone here is a bit of an entrepreneur and you can devise that particular arm robot, there are a billion cars to be served out there. So welcome to the startup. She has lost her job, probably, at least in Oxford, but I'm the one who is now scanning the beans. So when we talk about robots replacing humans or relocating jobs, because I'm pushing the buttons and I'm scanning the beans. And it's not exactly the robot that is doing it for me. It's just that, the digital has put that back on my shoulders. But plenty of other interfaces to come. These are all works that are essentially connecting A to B, and the job in the middle is an interface. Other interfaces will come, other interfaces will be required, not least because the world is getting more and more complicated or complex. in which case it means that the A's and the B's will be more and more interfaces will be generated. So I'm not quite sure that we are looking at the end of jobs, but this is the American situation. It's quite recent data. As you can tell that most work is in services. Manufacturing is going down. Government, which is another service, more or less, is stable. And agriculture is becoming increasingly negligible, both, just in case you wonder, in terms of GPS and in terms of number of people employed. The US could actually stop being so fussy about agriculture. I don't think the economy would actually notice that much. So what's happening here is that the, shall we say, BioWare is disappearing. The hardware is stable and the software kind of jobs are increasing. But in a software world, society, well, the introduction of ICTs, automation, robots and so on, is going to be hugely disruptive, of course. So this is the analysis that we had recently on the right-hand side, the American market for jobs, and what would happen if automation were massive. Polarization. Some jobs like, say, a philosopher, pretty safe. Not there are many of us around, but say your trainer, that's okay. You don't like to have robotic hands on your skin. But that paralegal in the office, probably gone. But the same analysis from Finland on the left-hand side. And what's the difference? That the Finnish colleagues, they actually took into account something that the American, sorry, the Oxford colleagues about America didn't, the impact of legislation. Think about this for a moment. How many trains do you know that go from A to B without a driver on the train? At least back in England, that's illegal. I mean, even the train from Oxford to London, which is indecently expensive, thank you so much, has to have a driver there by law. And it's a train. Now, pretty kind of constrained when it comes to a bus. And you think that the bus will have no driver? Oxford, London? I'm not so sure. Now, I'm not saying that law is the solution for the job market, etc. That's not the point. But I'm saying, you want to look into the seeds of time? Well, you better be sure that you're actually looking at all the seeds, not just the ones you fancy. And here, law would make a huge difference. Legislation, the kind of world we want to live in. Dependency. There's a bit of biblical overtone here, but I hope you don't mind. Those who live by the digit may die by the digit. Well, that's the cyber attack sort of test that I tell you indicates whether you are living in a hyper-historical society or not. The dependency on the infrastructure here is staggering. I'll tell you more in a moment. But clearly, we should be thinking in terms of the sort of engineering solutions that we have in other systems. Redundancy, resilience, those are the kind of words that you would like to see more often used in any big infrastructure, because we are going to be increasingly dependent on these infrastructures. Democratization is not a political term here. Is actually what we use in technology studies to mean the wide distribution, dissemination of a particular service or good. So the democratization of, for example, artificial intelligence, not the fancy one, not the Hollywood one, but the stupid one that you have in your pocket, pick up and find me the cheapest ticket, Oxford, London train, bing. And then whatever it does, and then it tells you. Or Siri, can you please find me a good recipe for the kind of ingredients I have in the fridge, being good. So that kind of ordinary stuff that makes life just a little bit easier. Well, once it's democratized, what exactly is going to happen here when, and this is an ongoing project, when the wrong kind of people get hold of it? Think of identity theft. Until recently, there was an art. Basically, you had to have an artisan stealing your identity online. But it's going to become an industrial enterprise once you have AI distributed, ordinary, in the hands of everyone, and say, dear AI, can you find the identity of Luciano for that particular bank? Click, and a few hours later, ding! And those are the data you need in order to go and impersonate that individual. Now, this democratization is cutting both sides, is going to empower, but also provide more risks. Exactly how we are dealing with this is, again, part of the design we are implementing today. Environment, and I'm going to go quickly because I know you know. If you don't have to be able to read all this, unless you're Superman, but look at the top and the bottom, the two arrows. The bottom is how much damage ICT at large, the digital, is causing to the world, because we need electricity to run all this, and it's hugely expensive. And the impact is immense. But the bottom, so that's the bottom, the top is how good the digital is for the environment. Do more with less, saving, making sure that there's more recycling, more reuse, etc. All that is precious. So what we're running here is a bit of a gambit. What we are doing here, although your average politician is not quite aware of that, is to run a bit of a risk. We hope that the light green will be quicker at saving the world than the dark green is at damaging the world. And it's the balance between the two that is going to determine whether the digital is going to save the world or actually kill it. The green and the blue here being not exactly uncontroversial marriage. So in this particular point, the real variable is time. Because if we have enough time, then it's not a problem. The good bit will overcome the bad bit. If there is not enough time, then it doesn't matter that there's so much good stuff happening. The bad stuff will be sufficient to kill this planet. Do we have enough time? Well, that's the current generation problem. I don't think that we have many generations down the road. So more to be done now, it's not an option, it's a must. Speaking of problems accumulating, this is a graph showing where we're going to leave, most of us. For those of you too far away, that's almost 70% of the population of the world, something like 6.5, 6.4 billion people living in huge, immense cities. The São Paulo of the world, I mean, I think São Paulo, you can check now, but I think it's as big as Australia. I mean, those immense sort of infrastructures whose complexity has to be dealt with in terms of more complexity. Has always been that way. We always dealt with complexity by adding layers of complexity and therefore more jobs. No, I'll go back to one of the previous slides. But in this case, is this complexity being properly designed? If you go to a conference where they speak about smart cities, most of it is advertisement. They show you these beautiful, clean, perfect, impeccable, small buildings, and suburbia, not in the picture. The countryside, not in the picture. So, well, that's not exactly planning for the future. Because this will be very hybrid, very mixed, very complicated environments with plenty of legacies, and we should be thinking now in terms of what design we want to implement. Freedom, our own freedom. Well, that's another problem because some of these technologies are very good at telling us what we're going to do. The example here is predictive policing. I don't know about Australia, but it's very popular in the UK and has been very popular in the States now for some time. Using large data sets, so-called big data, not exactly the correct terminology, but let's pass, and algorithms to make sure that you understand whether someone is going to reoffend or someone is a potential terrorist. You can imagine how popular it is with some corners of the police, the anti-terrorist units. Not a bad idea entirely, but remember, this has been built on software, for example, in this particular case, that was developed for earthquakes. There's an earthquake. Is it going to happen again? Where? Well, you have the data, and you can predict, perhaps, approximately when it's going to happen again. Well, the thing about earthquakes is that you haven't got much choice. They happen. You can't stop them. And they are pretty kind of cause and effect. Now, that's not exactly what we think in terms of human beings. They can change. We can influence behavior. We can make conditions more socially acceptable, etc. So exactly importing, and that's just one example, that sort of data science context into something that is way more human and flexible might cause a lot of problems. Biases or the identification of the wrong people, etc. So freedom here is a bit of a risk and we should be protecting it more carefully. Responsibility. Who's going to be blamed if something goes wrong? Once you are in a context where a lot of decisions have been taken in a mixed environment, there's a bit of an algorithm, there's a bit of human being, there's a bit of organizational infrastructure, and something didn't quite went the way it should have. To be more concrete, in terms of European legislation, the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation that is going to come into force pretty soon, has plenty to say about decisions taken solely, that's a technical term, by algorithms, including, for example, your application for a mortgage. Did the bank use just and only a piece of software? Well, if it did, and your mortgage has been rejected, your application hasn't been successful, what kind of information am I entitled to have? Well, at the moment, we have the right to be informed. Well, thank you. I mean, at least I've been told that I'm not going to get the mortgage. Do I have a right to an explanation? Not really. So that's very opaque. And that's, for example, some of the work I'm doing with Google, with my group, with DeepMind, in terms of transparency and accountability of algorithms. Responsibility here for something not actually working the way it should is a bit opaque and distributed. Adaptability. This is probably something that might be a little bit less well-known to everybody here. That is just one simple graph that I picked up among many others discussing programmatic advertising. Programmatic advertising is what happens in front of your eyes in a blink of a second when you click on that particular page and there's a bit of advertisement for you tailored around your profile and your data. Someone fought a big battle behind it. That battle has been fought by software. That software is attracting, by 2017, $33 billion worth of investment and spending to make sure that you look at those shoes, you didn't look at that T-shirt. Now, in this context, adaptability of the human, we're flexible, we're fragile, we're malleable. You go to a restaurant, you're not quite sure what you want to choose, and maybe the waiter says, oh, Luciano, this is really good today. So, okay, yeah, why not? Let's have that. And if it's not the waitress, but it's actually Amazon, it tells you, look, you read the first Harry Potter, you might be interested in the second Harry Potter. Says, yeah, why not? I want to read something. I'm pretty open-minded. And I read the second Harry Potter. I buy the second one. And guess what? The next time I go on Amazon, it will recommend the third Harry Potter and the fourth and the fifth. And God knows how many are there. But I read all of them because I was malleable. I was influenceable. I was adaptable. And someone there was stubborn, reluctant to give in, constantly dropping that bit of water on me, the stone. And the stone has been carved nicely, smoothly, into reading every Harry Potter ever published. And I didn't read anything else. And that was not very smart of me, you know, the professor from Oxford. So that adaptability is something really serious. And you might think, okay, well, Amazon, who cares? But multiply this for 1,000 different moments in your life where is that particular choice or that particular option that you've been gently nudging, you get a Nobel Prize these days for that, gently nudging in that direction, and bingo, you know that we need to be a little bit more careful about this because we are quite exceptional. Although that's the last point I want to raise, and then we come towards the final bit of this talk. Exceptional. In what way? Exactly. Because we used to be at the center of the universe. That's the first picture out there, if you don't recognize Mr. Copernicus. And that has gone a long time away. We were pushed out of that centrality. We're not at the center of the universe anymore. And it was upsetting. We didn't like it. If you read the history of the time, it was something that the local and contemporary culture disliked deeply. Meaning also people being burned for that level of dislike. So Darwin, well, that was not equally well received, but we thought we were at the center of the animal kingdom. And we, by Darwin, were misplaced and said, look, get out of here. No, you're not at the center of the animal kingdom either. And that's humbling. It's unpleasant. And then the third guy there, Freud, says, well, you know what? I'm bringing you, and actually that's Freud putting the previous two in that line, good advertisement, says, I'm bringing a third revolution here. The third revolution in your centrality is that you're not at the center of the mental life either. God knows why you're doing what you're doing. Normally, I blame my mom, but that's easy. I learned that lesson, at least. So we're not at the center of the universe. We're not at the center of the animal kingdom. We're not at the center of the mental life. So can we be at the center of anything here? Well, for some time, we retrenched into the center of that particular space I introduced before, the infosphere. Well, we are the ones who actually handle information better than anyone else. I can play chess better than anyone else. I can park the car better than anyone else. I can fly the airplane better than anyone else. I can find the fridge better than anyone, etc. You know where I'm going. Well, you're not. We're not. There are all these beautiful, amazing things out there that do that better than you, faster than you. In fact, by now, instead of you. And so we're not at the center of the infosphere either. And that's Alan Turing. Four revolutions that have undermined our exceptionalism at the center of the universe. And how exactly are we going to regain some self-esteem? Well, I'll tell you more in a moment, but I think we should stop trying to put ourselves at the center of anything. Four lessons. Are we finally getting the message? And the message here is that it's great to be on the side of things. It's great to be at the service of, in other words, on the periphery of things. Our special role, and I'll tell you more in a moment, is not to be at the center of anything, but being at the service of something else that is put at the center. And any teacher here would know exactly what I'm saying. Anyone who works in a hospital knows exactly what I'm saying. Anyone who has a profession where essentially you are at the service of someone else knows exactly that you're not at the center. You put the patient, the student, or perhaps even the person at the supermarket at the center. Custom-centric kind of business? Oh, no, welcome to the fourth revolution. They don't put it that way, but I mean, essentially, that's the idea. So, 10 challenges. How do we cope with the challenges? And that's the, not closing the circle now. So, I haven't said much, to be honest, although I use a lot of words to say little. So, one point, cut and paste, consequences, and some problems caused by that cutting and pasting together, things that we haven't cut and pasted in the past. How do we reorganize this? Well, the counterbalance force of cutting and pasting is design. Now, this is not something that philosophers are too keen on stressing. If you pick up a book in philosophy of science or the history of science, they will all be quite keen on understanding innovation, more on this in a moment, in terms of discovery or invention. Design never gets any press, not good press, just not press at all. But that is, as far as I'm concerned, the way forward, the solution. Not least because I'm actually on record describing philosophy as conceptual design, dealing with all the problems to find solutions that provide a variety of possibilities. So design here is, for the rest of the time left, the idea that the cleaving power provides more affordances and less constraints. So if you are running a mental experiment, say a thought experiment, you're alone in the universe, there's only one stone in front of you, there's no design. You can play with the stone, you can kick the stone, you admire the stone, but you can't design anything. But if you have many stones, cut and paste, well then, there's plenty of design, one on top of each other, one next to the other. So all of a sudden, what is the counter force to the cleaving power is the designing opportunity that we have. I told you that innovation normally is described as either invention, someone invents the wheel, or discovery, someone goes on the other side and maybe gets all the way here. That's not the only way of innovating. There's a major force there. It's called design. And that seems to me the real force that we are enjoying and should be shaping today. So imagine that innovation is like a stall with three legs. Every moment of innovation is actually based on discovery, invention, and design. But every time in our sort of history has been leaning a little bit more on one or the other. This is the age of discovery, the age of invention, and guess what? The age of design today. So in this particular case, we have the step forward, as it were, as the real moment of change, of improvement. So finally, the conclusion about the green and blue. So what has got all this to do with putting together the digital and the environmental? Well, I think that our age is the age of design. It should be the age of good design. Good as in digital ethics, good. Something needs to be said on this. What is exactly design? And I cannot tell you how impressed I was by the number of Vespa I saw in this city. I mean, you know, being the proud owner of a Vespa in Oxford, quite a unique thing, I thought, oh, there must be plenty of Italians here because I've never seen a city with so many Vespas apart from Rome. So I thought that was, again, totally accidental. That slide was before coming to Melbourne. But exactly what is design here and why we can do good design? Well, imagine that design is a bit of putting together affordances, constraints, to solve a problem in view of a purpose. You don't have to agree with me, as long as you know what we are disagreeing about. It's the purpose here that makes the difference. It's the orientation of that design. And if you get that design in terms of a value-driven design for the digital, well, bingo, that's exactly what I'm suggesting, that we should remember for future generations to look back and say, thank you, we should do the kind of design that, in terms of purpose, has a bit of values in it for the society we want, so that all that cutting and pasting is going the right direction, and those challenges are actually resolved as good opportunities. I told you a moment ago that all this has got to do with a lot with us and our exceptional nation. Now, there are many ways of understanding ourselves as special. The one I would like to suggest is that something that leaves open for the believers and the non-believers a bit of empty space to move forward to. If you look at human beings, we're really quite an extraordinary, strange bit of an oddity in this universe. And I don't mean that as a plus, I mean that as a minus. Remember, we're not at the center of anything. We're not the, for the younger among us, the Bazinga moment of, so those of you who actually follow that kind of stuff. We're not the super cool moment in the history of evolution. No, we're not. We're just really kind of a glitch. It's a beautiful glitch because it has managed to survive and improve, but that takes nothing away from the fact that we are an oddity, the sort of a odd outlier in the normal evolution of things. Now, if we are an oddity for some people, that oddity is not a glitch, it's not a bug, it's a feature put there by someone who actually designed the whole thing properly. Well, I'm happy to leave that open to anyone who believes that, and that's okay. So there is a designer, and the glitch is actually a feature, and that God out there is designing things properly. For people who are on the other side, like myself, it's more like a real accidental thing. Nature made a mistake, and that mistake survived and became who we are. But that sort of mistake, that beautiful glitch, today is more properly, more, I think, more intelligently understood in terms of, for the computer scientists among us, in terms of level of abstraction. The level of abstraction that we should adopt to look at that beautiful glitch is an informational organism. It's not the only way of looking at humanity, by far. But today, I think, it's better than describing someone as mostly water. That would be a chemical, not look of their individual, which is true as well. I mean, we are 80%, 90% of water. The difference between me and a jar of Nescafe is negligible in terms of water. So not exactly not reassuring, I know. But, you know, if you look at ourselves, instead of like a jar of Nescafe plus 80 liters of water, but more in terms of an informational organism, then some of the things I've said so far, they start making a different sense, I hope. Because if we are those kind of information organisms, we're also very fragile. Remember, the adaptability, the freedom, the pushing, the complexity, the reliance, all those things mean we need to be careful. We need to understand much better what we're doing to ourselves through our technologies. The digital should be, must be friendly to the beautiful glitch. And that's the kind of message that if you need to remember anything from this time spent together, I hope you will take with you. So there's a human project. I remember I said 8 points, and you're always suspicious when you say eight and there are two missing. Those are the other two missing. They are the two moments of gluing and ungluing of the world. We've been living with capitalism and consumerism as a block. We understood from modernity that was the only way of understanding capitalism. Not true. Not longer true. Okay chapter that we leave behind, but the new chapter could be a way of ungluing capitalism from consumerism and gluing it to fostering the world as opposed to consuming it to death. It's perfectly possible. It's called green economy, sharing economy, you name it economy. But it makes a lot of sense to start thinking in that direction. At that point, talking to companies as good corporate citizens makes a lot of sense, especially in corners of the world that can afford this compared to corners which are still in need of a consumeristic approach to capitalism. And how to do that? Well, we could actually put together the natural and the technological. Fusis and techne, to use Greek words, be fancy, into some kind of a tea ecology or technology without the letters that could put together these two forces in a way that we haven't for a long, long time. The use of the Greek words there is done on purpose because since the Greeks, we have split the two. We have considered that nature and technology were not friends. And in fact, technology wasn't even something worth considering because what was really worth considering was real knowledge, episteme behind. So the point here becomes, how can we recombine these forces so that those challenges and that cutting and paste is good design and the challenges become less pressing or sometimes opportunities? The difficult question that we have in front of us is that we don't have a clear sense yet of what the question mark should we replace by. We've been already there with the biosphere. When it comes to biosphere, we know what we mean by sustainability. We haven't done it yet. We are in the process of doing it, but but at least we have a sense of the sort of direction we want to take. But what is exactly sustainability like when it comes to the infosphere? Social preferability? That's a fancy word that doesn't really cut deeply enough, but that's, some, for example, a project that I'm trying to develop with Microsoft. What exactly means to be a good citizen in the infosphere in the same way as we are good citizens, we go to the supermarket and we look at sustainably fish, for example. So to conclude, I think what we should do for the following few years in front of us in order to get there, I think we should really think much more deeply about what we're doing. Now, slow down a little bit and think more. All those slogans on the walls of these startups and non-startups, fail often, fail fast, break it often, break it fast. Are you insane? Do you understand what it means to break and fail in terms of outsourcing externalities of that failure, of the cost of all that? No, no, break nothing. And don't fail if you can, because that's exactly the fragility that we're dealing with today. So this kind of a Californian attitude, I'm not impressed. And design better. Design better for the future, for the long term, not for consuming something that is supposed to break down in a number of maybe few months so that it has to be replaced by something else. We will be sold the next smartphone as the ultimate thing, to be told 6 months later that that's not good enough. Well, that's fine. But maybe there are lots of stuff that should be there for the long term, because consuming all those things is not the real business. And be mindful, and there's a difference between careful and mindful. Careful means you really don't want to run risks. Mindful is I want to assess the risk and understand which risk I can take and which are not to be taken. So I like mindfulness as opposed to being careful and better safe than sorry. Not what I'm suggesting. But if you dare, if you run some risk, make sure that you're actually considering what's going to happen so that those future generations will look back and be happy. And since we started with Shakespeare, I thought we should end with Shakespeare. This Cassius, and you know, this also not going to end well. No, these are called tragedies for a reason. It says, men are sometime our masters of their fate. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves, that we are underling. We don't have to be. The future is in our hands. We have design on our side. We can start with the right premises. If we do that, the future generations will be very grateful. Thank you.
Great. I love the bit about the dishwashing outcomes and artificial intelligence. Definitely a lot to ponder in there. For more information on this and many other fascinating topics around the Network Society, visit our website, networksociety.unimob.edu.au. Or let us know what you think on Twitter. We're at MelbNSI. That's MelbNSI. See you next time.